You're listening to episode 91 of 88 Cups of Tea with Yin Chang.
Am I doing this right? Hi, I'm your host, Yin Chang, and thanks for joining me on 88 Cups of Tea. This podcast is created to leave you feeling motivated from interviews with storytellers, where we learn how they create opportunities for a successful career without losing sight of the values that make us human. Whew, that was a really long run-on sentence.
I am totally geeking out about thanking Overdrive for sponsoring today's new episode. I have been a fan for 6 years, and I'm so honored to share the exciting news about their brand new app called Libby. Libby is designed for readers to discover and enjoy ebooks and audiobooks from your library. I have way more amazing details to share with you, so please be sure to hang around at the end of the show. I also wanted to take a moment to thank you all for being so incredibly supportive of our show. I appreciate each and every one of you for joining us every week, and if you just found our show, thank you for making your way through our archive of episodes. I also wanted to say thank you to all of you who've been recommending our podcast to your friends. I've been seeing you all on Twitter and Instagram and Facebook with your recommendations, so thank you so much for that. That really helps us a lot in growing our community, and I really feel the love, and trust me, it's mutual. If you could head over to iTunes and subscribe to 88 Cups of Tea and leave a rating and review for our show, I would really appreciate it. By doing so, you're helping us become more searchable for new listeners to discover us on iTunes. Thank you so much in advance for helping me out and spreading the word. By the way, if you're looking for a way to connect with other writers in our storyteller tribe, come hang out with us in our private Facebook group and make new friends. We check in with each other about our work in progress and share resources on the craft, in addition to chatting about bookish-related things. Stop by facebook.com/groups/88cupsoftea. You'll feel right at home, and I'm so excited to hang out with you in there. That's facebook.com/groups/88cupsoftea. Before we get into the details of today's episode, I'd love to wish Tracy Badwa and Darnisha Bishop from our community a very happy birthday. May all of your dreams and wishes come true, and thank you so much for being such awesome listeners. We have Kirsten White with us this week, the New York Times bestselling author of And I Darken, a series that has been compared to Game of Thrones for the YA community. Kirsten and I recorded our conversation late last year, and I'm so excited to finally publish her episode the same month that her highly anticipated sequel, Now I Rise, is releasing. In our conversation today, Kirsten shares the story behind the title, And I Darken, and walks us through the historical research process for her series. For those of you who love discussions about the craft of writing, you're going to love our discussion about creating badass characters. Kirsten goes into detail about crafting a page-turner novel with memorable, multi-layered characters and how to create authentic characters by channeling your inner feelings. We dig even deeper and talk about how understanding characters' motivations will help your readers understand your characters' decisions. We also talk about how to deal with rejection and how to grow from it and make it work for you rather than against you. And we unpack the value a strong editor can bring to your manuscript and the influential ways a writing partner can help strengthen your craft. You'll even hear tips and tricks on finding the writing partner that's suited for you. This is a really fun episode, and I am so excited for you to finally hear it. Now let's dive right in.
We have the lovely Kirsten White with us. I am so excited to have her on. Kirsten, how are you?
I am fantastic. I am so excited to be here today.
We are so excited to have you on. I'd love to kick it off by asking you how you fell in love with writing.
I'm writing a book three trilogy, so right now I'm like, I hate writing. But that's not true. Even when I'm not writing, I'm thinking about writing. I've just always loved it. I think I was encouraged at a really young age by my parents, who would see me come home with these assignments from school and would tell me how fantastic they were. In retrospect, they probably were not. But having that extra level of encouragement from when I was very young, it was always a very real thing to me that being a writer was something that you could do. And I've always been the type of person who tells myself stories in my head, which I thought everybody did, but it turns out they don't. I have really high anxiety. I found when I was a teenager that if I had a story going in the back of my head, I could feed that to the anxiety so that instead of tearing myself apart with thoughts, I could just give it a story. Transitioning into writing was just a very natural thing for me. And it's one of those things where I'm going to do it forever, no matter what.
I love that you're able to use writing as a coping mechanism for anxiety. I'm realizing now as I'm older, I do get anxiety at times. I love that you mentioned that. It's very encouraging. There are a lot of writers who do struggle with anxiety. Very encouraging to hear that. And for others who haven't tried writing, maybe that would be very therapeutic in a way. When you're younger, you knew it was a possibility to be a writer. Do you remember the moment where you're like, oh, I know this can be a career? Or was it something that was innate?
I'm not really sure because it was just always the thing that I was going to do. As far back as second grade, career week, they had all of the girls cut out nurses and all of the boys cut out firemen, which is its own thing. I remember raising my hand and being to the teacher saying, can I leave the hat off of my nurse because she's going to be a writer and a mom? My parents always got me books. They always encouraged my writing. I still remember my mom and I went to a library and saw Gary Paulsen, who wrote Hatchet. And so it was always a very real thing to me. It wasn't this abstract concept. You talk to some kids and they feel books just sort of exist. But for me, it was always very much a reality that somebody writes these books. That's a thing that you can do. So yeah, it was always my goal.
Your parents, what did they do for their careers?
My dad is a computer programmer. And oh, wow. My mom was a stay-at-home mom who did a lot of volunteer work in the school system. She actually organized an I Can Read reading recovery program for the entire area that we lived in because there wasn't one. At the time, I was just, oh yeah, that's something that moms do. But I look back on that, and my mom did not have any struggling readers. We were all very precocious readers and loved reading. But she went into the community and she saw that there was a need and she knew how important it was for kids to be able to read at grade level and to be able to access those stories in those books. And so she saw that hole and she filled it, which I find just really remarkable and says a lot about the importance and value that my family placed on literacy, which obviously had a huge impact on me.
I'm sure you pass that on to your children. One of them is a toddler, so not just yet, but then the 12-year-old, I'm sure you encourage a lot of writing and reading.
It's hilarious because writing is such a real thing to them and creating books that I went into my 10-year-old son's bedroom and I was looking through one of his notebooks. You know, a lot of kids will write the beginning of a story or something. He actually had a 12-chapter outline.
What?
Book. Yeah, so he's not writing snippets of stories. He's actually outlining the first book in a series. And it was a legitimately good outline. The funniest thing is, I don't outline.
I was just going to say, wait, did he get that from you? But he doesn't.
No.
What?
I don't outline.
Where on earth did this genius find out to outline? My gosh, she's like a little Einstein walking around.
Yeah, and it's funny because I have shared my writing with them. I have a middle grade book called Beanstalker coming out next year. And that one was really fun because I got to read it to them as I was writing. But for the most part, they read a ton and they absorb what they read and get this real sense for stories. I would be surprised if one or both of them doesn't end up being a writer. I'm like, oh, I'm so sorry. I should have given you a more practical career. But it is super fun because stories and writing is such an everyday thing for them and they see what I do and they see how hard I work at it. And I think it's been a really, really good thing in their lives.
As you're telling me this, I'm trying to imagine myself with my mom growing up instead of a businesswoman, if she was a writer. Wow, things would be very different. You and your family sound amazing and your mom especially. Thank you for sharing that. You did mention Beanstalker. That's the book that you were reading to your kids as you were writing it. Did your kids ever give you feedback? Did that affect your book that's coming out? Or did you just read it more as a story time and as a fun bonding experience?
Oh, no, I totally use them as a sounding board. Humorous book, I would have something that I thought was really funny. So I'm kind of watching them as I'm reading it aloud. And if they didn't react to something that I thought was funny, I was like, okay, well, that's clearly not hitting the right notes for my target audience. So I rework it. And then it was just so cute because at one point I was reading this passage and I used the same word twice in the same paragraph. And I was like, oh, I need a different word that means the same thing. And so my son was like, well, you should use this word. And I'm like, oh, you're right. I should.
Oh,
and so that
God.
Was just so fun because A, it helped me selfishly. I didn't even pay them for that. And B, he really felt he got to contribute to my book. And it was just a really fun thing. I can't really do that with my teen books. I can't say, hey, kids, tell me if this impaling passage is open up without being overwhelming. I don't involve them with that book. But so the middle grade was really fun to sort of use them as my target audience and make sure everything was hitting the way that I wanted it to.
That is so cool. Does your husband ever jump in to listen to the stories too?
He actually helps me with the YA a lot. I use him. I talk through plot problems with him. Actually, Andy Darkham wouldn't exist without him. We met right after he came home from spending 2 years living in Romania. When I went to ask him out for the first time, I was like, hey, what are you doing? And he's like, oh, I'm just writing emails in Romanian. And I was like, oh, I just finished doing the same thing. Let's go out. It was a lie. I don't speak Romanian, but he went out with me and then the next summer we got married. So it worked out. He is actually the history buff in our family and he's the one who knew all of that history and would tell me about it. And he turned it from history into stories. stories for me. We went to Romania in 2010 because he knows the country and speaks the language. So that whole YA series exists really because of him. He definitely helps me more in, he's a sounding board for plotting. He does read my work, but he doesn't give a lot of critical feedback, which is probably good for our marriage.
It's like, all right, tonight, honey, you're sleeping on the couch because you totally insulted my character.
You thought that plot thread was weak? Guess what else?
That is so funny. You know what? That's amazing that you have the best of both worlds. You have your hubby for the YA, and then you have the children for the middle school novels.
Yeah, I really planned that well, didn't I?
Mom, I was going to say, you are a little psychic. You would look into your future and you just knew exactly what to do. And I darkened. Let's just start off by saying, man, the cover is gorgeous. Did you have any idea that it was going to come out that way?
No, and you know what's so funny, and I've never told this story before, maybe I shouldn't even, but they always do like a preliminary mock-up of this is what it's going to look like before they bring on an artist. Sam Weber did the art for this. They're both paintings, which is amazing. So they sent me the preliminary mock-up, and I hated it. It looked very different. And I'm not good at visualizing things. They say this is the general tone that we're going for. This is a direction. But I can't see past what's actually in front of me. I got my friend Natalie Whipple, who is also a YA author but very talented with art and Photoshop, to mock up a couple of alternatives. And I sent them to my publisher and they were like, okay, thanks, but I think we're going to go in this first direction. And then they sent me the final one. I was like, oh, I'm so sorry. I doubted you.
Thank goodness they went ahead and said that they're going to go the first direction, right?
Thank goodness they were like, whatever, Kirsten, we know what we're doing. I very much learned that lesson where I'm like, you guys do your thing. I trust you.
You do you. I'll do me. Done and done.
I'll just wait and open up the image and be like, oh my gosh, that's amazing. I love these covers. I love, too, that they could be very static. I mean, it's a flower and a weapon, right? Yeah. But there's so much movement and yes. They're very, very dynamic covers, yes. Which I just love. I'm so happy with them.
Yes, they're gorgeous. I'm telling you, when you go in the bookstores and you see that being displayed, you can't help but stop. It really captures your attention and you just want to stop and look. The title, too, is just so beautiful. And I Darken. It just rolls off your tongue beautifully. And you're just like, oh gosh, I have to see what this is about. And you just can't help but just pick it up, read what it's about. And then you're like, okay, I have to buy it. It's one of those books. And you got it well packaged with the cover, too. You got a great team.
My editor also picked the title.
Really?
I lucked out with her. So my editor is Wendy Loja at Delacorte, and she has been an absolute champion for the book from day one. Really, it's just all over the entire thing from beginning to end. It's very, very shaped by her. People sometimes ask if I would ever self-publish older books that I wrote that didn't make the cut or whatever, and I never would. Because for me personally, an editor just brings so much value. We said the cover where I was like, I don't get it. And then I saw it and I was like, oh, I get it. But yeah, we couldn't think of a title. The original title had the word dragon in it, which was historical, but made it feel like fantasy. She came back and she had done all of this research and she found Mihai Eminescu, who's this preeminent Romanian poet. And he has this really just gorgeous, very melancholy poem about growing up and about how as we grow up, we lose this innocence and hope of childhood. And the last line is, and I'm going to paraphrase it because I can't remember it exactly, says, the years go on and I darken. And she was like, what if we use and I darken? And she listed the three titles for the series. And I just got chills. And it was this absolute, yes, that's exactly it moment. So yeah, my editor came up with my gorgeous title.
Oh my gosh, that's amazing. She's a genius. That title, it's on the money. What about And I Rise? Was that with you and the editor?
That was also her. It was originally And I Rise, and we shifted it to Now I Rise just so that it looked a little bit different, so that people didn't see it and think like, oh, did I already read that book or not? She came up actually with all three titles. And I Darken, Now I Rise, and then book three, which I can't tell you yet. We do know the titles for the whole series. And yeah, she came up with all of them. Bless her forever. She is brilliant.
Wow, that's amazing. I love, 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 love that. Going into this, meeting your editor, did you reach out and did you do your research saying, okay, this is the editor I want to work with specifically? Or was she recommended to you by your literary agent?
As I get further in my career, because you know, I'm 9 books in now. I know a lot of people. I've worked with a lot of different people through anthologies and that type of thing. I find myself more and more doing less of the let's go out wide and hit everyone we can and more of I want to work with this person or this person because I feel like we would be a good fit. And I've been very fortunate that all of the editors that I've worked with, I've gotten along very well with and I have just tremendous respect for. But Wendy definitely was a person where when We were first going out with Andy Darkin. It was a partial and a pitch, and we definitely targeted her because we knew that she wanted to work with me. She had made that pretty clear over the years. We joked that she was flirting with us. And so my agent and I obviously discussed it, and she was the top of our list. So we definitely targeted her. With my middle grade, it happened very sort of backwards. I had made a series of jokes on Twitter about fairy tales starring serial killers because I'm a bright, cheery, happy person. Aaron Black at Scholastic, whom I had known because of a project that didn't end up happening, emailed me and said, I really feel like there's a book there and I want it. So we went back and forth for a little while. And when I finally settled on what I wanted to write, then I pitched it to her, but I only pitched it to her. I didn't go wide because I felt she was going to add value to the project. And that for me at this stage is the most important thing. I want an editor who really gets it, who wants to work with me, and who I feel like is the best fit for the project. And so I've been really, really fortunate in that I've been able to find those editors for everything I've wanted to do.
Do you mind me asking, Kirsten, is there a little checklist for yourself that you make where you're like, okay, if they meet these top three criteria, then yes, I'm definitely going with this editor over that one. Is there something that makes them stand out more to you than somebody else? If, let's say, there's listeners out there who are struggling, not sure which editor to go with, is there something that helps you figure out, all right, this is the one, I need to be with this one?
Oh, that's a good question. I think I'm not nearly as organized as you are, which, by the way, the series of reminders that were emailed for this podcast were the greatest thing ever. And I can tell you work with us super flighty, disorganized authors a lot. So I was like, this is the most amazing thing ever.
Thank you.
I really, really appreciated that because I'm not an organized person and I do everything all the time. So part of it is, you know, I do have my agent, Michelle Wolfson, who I've had since the beginning of my career, and she's very, very much a partner, which I love and appreciate. And so she helps find those people that she thinks would be a good fit for me. And for me, it's really more of a gut thing. Wendy called when we were on sub with Andy Darkin, and she loved it and she got it, and she got it in a way where she, even from the beginning, said, I was going to structure it very differently. And from that very first phone call, she said, I love this. I feel like it should not be structured that way. I feel like it should be dual point of view from Lotta and Radu. And as soon as she said that, I was like, oh, absolutely, it should be. I knew from day one that she understood it and that she would really help shape it into what I wanted it to be. Because a good editor takes your book and makes it even more what you were trying to write. I think sometimes there's this fear that editors are going to change what you do or try their own. I have heard some stories about the occasional nightmare edit where it doesn't feel like the author's book anymore. I've never had that. And I think that's very, very rare because editors really are there to make it more your book and more what you wanted it to be. You take it as far as you can, and then an editor shows you the next step. So yeah, for me, it's really just more of a, do I connect with this person? Do I feel like they understand what I'm trying to do and will help me get there? And I think that passion is probably the most important thing because, you know, you've got the editors who have the huge reputations and maybe they're powerhouse editors, but if your project isn't a priority, it's going to show. I always go with editor that I feel really gets it and really, really wants it because then everybody is the same level of investment and committed to working on it.
Yes, absolutely. Thank you for that. I think that's super helpful and very generous of you. I'd love to really dive into more about the background of Andy Darkin. And I'd love to kick it off with a question from one of our awesome listeners, Angela Williams. Angela says she loves how in your book, Andy Darkin, you created a female character, Lotta, who is strong and dangerous and pretty traditionally unlikable. And Angela loves the character, like really loves the character. And it was so refreshing for her to read something where a girl was allowed to be angry and vengeful and proud. I think that's what she loves most about Lotta, actually. And she'd love to know if there was ever any pushback from editors, agents, or publishers about this character?
You know, what's funny is I expected pushback for this series because Lotta is so deeply unlikable. And then I have dual point of view. I have a girl who's angry and brutal and vicious, and I have a boy who's gentle and tender and not straight.
Yes.
And so I really was expecting, well, at some point I'm going to have to fight for these. And I never did. And that's one thing, another thing that I just love so much about my editor and my publisher is they treated this like a big book from day one, and they never questioned that. Probably the most pushback I got was from myself, because I kept worrying as I was writing, Lotta is just so unlikable. And at one point I was like, maybe I should have some sort of thread where she loves animals and she's really nice to animals, because I've got to give her some sort of redeeming quality. But then I realized, I'm like, you know, to Lotta, a horse gets her from point A to point B. And as long as it does that, it served its purpose. She's not going to be, I'm going to hang out in the stables and pet the horses. Like, that's just not her. So I really had to resist the impulse to pull my punches and to soften her, because I have had main characters in the past that people have not liked because they were too angry. So, you know, of course I go and write the angriest character ever. Oh, she was too angry. Oh, you're right. Okay, well, here's Lotta. I think the thing that works with Lotta is because she's so unapologetic, and she does go so far past likable that it becomes this very freeing, almost wish fulfillment thing where I got to be, how would I respond in this situation? Okay, well, Lotta's going to do the opposite. And so it was really a sort of cathartic experience to write her. And I think people have really responded really positively to her. And I didn't ever get any pushback on an editorial level. They loved her. The only thing my editor has ever asked is, in book two culminates with something not nice. I know that's shocking. And all she asked was, I want more justification. I want to understand more why she does this. So she didn't want her to not do it. She just wanted to completely ground the reader so that the reader understood 100% why Lotta would make this decision. Mm-hmm. And that was absolutely the right call. I've got such a great team that really understands what we're doing with this book and this series and these characters. And it's been so great to see people really embrace Lotta. It's been surprising.
Where did Lotta come from? What was the inspiration behind that?
I actually remember the exact moment I got the idea for this book, and it was because of my husband. I knew all the history. I knew that Vlad the Impaler, who Lotta is based on, grew up as a contemporary of Mehmet the Conqueror, that they would have grown up together, and then they went on to fight each other, and that they were both such dynamic people who did such different things when they got to power. I was sitting in the back of my mom's SUV as my husband was telling my mom all about this history, and wondering, like, how do normal people get to the point where they can justify committing atrocities in the name of their goals? Because it's a process. It has to be a process. You don't wake up one morning and be like, all right, well, now I'm going to impale 20,000 people to make a point. I mean, I don't. Maybe you do.
I do it all the time.
Yeah, right? Liam, like, yeah, maybe. I was thinking about that. Then I thought, well, what if he had been a girl? Because it just makes so much more sense to me how brutal Vlad was, and he never backed down, and he was absolutely rigid in justice and in his pursuit of his goals. And I thought, well, if he had been a girl, that would make so much more sense. Because women, we know, have to fight still. We have to fight harder. We have to be better. We have to be smarter. We have to be stronger, just to be on a level playing field. And so once I realized that, had that moment of what if he had been a girl, suddenly his choices and everything that he did made so much more sense to me if it were a woman doing them. Because as bad as it is now, it was obviously way worse then. And so women who had power back then were way worse, and they had to be. Otherwise, it would be taken from them. One of my favorite stories is about Theodora of Byzantium, who was a co-emperor with Justinian in the fairly early days of the Byzantine Empire. At one point, there was this riot. The rival political party was putting up another person for the throne. And Justinian and all his advisors were like, we got to get out of here. We're going to get killed. But Theodora, who was not born to power, she was actually an actress, which was code word for a prostitute at the time, who had just found him and they'd fallen in love, and he respected her so much that he gave her power. She was like, heck no, we are not leaving, because if we leave, we're never getting power back. Because she knew what it was to be powerless, and they didn't. They didn't understand that, and they hadn't had to work as hard as she had in order to have safety and power in her life. And so she was like, we are not leaving the city. We are going to go into that stadium, and we're going to kill everyone who opposes us. So they did, and she saved Justinian's throne. And she's actually the person who started construction on the Hagia Sophia, which still stands in Istanbul. I get so confused. I'm like, Constantinople. No, Istanbul. This is the problem with writing historical fiction. So you look at women like that, there is a precedent for this type of person and this type of path to power. And so I very much researched a lot of historical women in power, what they did to get power, what they did to keep it, ways they lost it. And that all informed who Lotta was. But I think personally, while I am definitely way more of a Radu than a Lotta, all women have that sort of core of anger. We're just taught to leave it alone. You ignore it because anger is not a feminine emotion. I found as I've gotten older, I'm in my 30s now, oh wait, I don't have to care what other people think about me. I can do things because I like them. I can feel things because they're what I feel. And I don't have to filter that or shield that in order to protect what other people think of me, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. I also buzz my hair now. Screw you. That sort of core of anger, I think we all have. And that was one, as I mentioned, writing Lotta was very cathartic because I got to say, if I didn't have to worry about anything other than what I wanted, what would I do? And you know, it's not always the nice thing or the kind thing or the thing that's best for everyone. It's just the thing that's best for you. And I'm not saying we should live our lives that way. I certainly don't. It's fun to explore in fiction. And to be able to say, I'm really pissed off about a lot of things. I'm going to channel that into this series and into this character.
I agree 100%. Lotta is so multidimensional and she's got a lot going on. How are you able to pack everything that you just said into the character Lotta for your writing process?
I did definitely have to outline these books more than I normally do, just because they are very heavily historically based. And I did a ton of research, and thousands and thousands of pages of research on the actual historical figures and timelines so that I would be as accurate as I could in the ways that I could. I mean, obviously, I gender swapped a major historical figure. This is not straight up history. So it was kind of nice having that roadmap because I did know a lot about Vlad's life, how he grew up, how he came into power. And so I very heavily based Lotta's journey on that. But that's part of why I actually started the book with her birth, which, you know, is a little bit of an odd choice in young adult to start at a character's birth and take them through childhood and even very young teen years. You don't see that a lot. But it was really important to me to root the readers in everything that went into making Lotta who she is. Because if we understand everywhere she came from and everything that went into informing the type of person that she becomes, we understand her decisions in a way that we wouldn't if I just had her pop up at age 17, super mean. For me, it was very much knowing exactly where they came from. And I also always know where I'm aiming for as far as the end game. Not even just with book one, but overall series. Where am I ending these characters? And so that I know this is my path to get there. Although it's been interesting, I have had the ending of this series in mind since day one, since I got the idea. Now, as I'm into drafting book three, I realized I don't want to end it that way anymore, which has never happened to me before. I always know my endings and I always write toward them. I will admit, recent events in the world around us, in the USA specifically, made me take a look at what I was writing and decide to do something different. So that's a little exciting slash terrifying that this ending sequence I had been writing to, I'm not going to do anymore. I'm changing it. And I think that's one of the nice things about writing a series is that you do have that space and you do have that flexibility to change and to react and respond. And the idea that I had of who Lotta's character was has shifted as I've written her and as I've gotten to know her. So I agree, you definitely have to know your character's motivations and know where you're going with them. But one of the magic things about writing is you think you know everything that's going to happen, and you should because it's all coming from your head, but it still manages to surprise you. And these characters that you created still somehow manage to become their own people and to shift the stories in ways that you never could have anticipated. So that, to me, I do like to know my characters at the beginning, but it's also really fascinating to me the ways that they reveal themselves as the story progresses that are not necessarily what you thought they would be.
Absolutely. You allow some flexibility in there. I do agree that it does reveal a lot more than if you were to stay point by point within a structure. And for Now I Rise, did it follow the same path that you envisioned since the first book, or did it also take a change change and a turn.
The biggest change was as I was writing Anti-Darken, I wasn't certain if the books were going to be two books or three books. When I was about two-thirds through Anti-Darken, I realized there was no logical way to make it. There was no good break for two books. Because I feel like stories have shapes. They have an arc. There was no logical story arc to making it into two books. There was no clean break. There was no satisfying story. Even when I'm writing series, it's really important to me that each book feels essential and feels like a satisfying storytelling experience. Like you've accomplished something with the characters as a reader. Like, do you ever read a book and it's a book in a series and it really just feels like half of a story? And that bothers me because obviously you have to have threads that go through. You have to have the things that you're building toward because a book two really is just like the balancing point between book one and book three, which makes it very challenging for it to feel like a satisfying narrative that justifies its inclusion. And so as I was writing book one, I was trying to see if I could do it in two books because trilogies are awful. They're so hard to write. I got to a certain point, I was like, unless these books are 800 pages each, and even then, it was a three-part story. It wasn't a two-part story. Fortunately, again, my editor, who is wonderful, I thought I was going to have to convince her. So I talked to my agent. I was like, can we set up a call where I can try and talk her into making this a trilogy instead of a duology? And so she emailed my editor and was like, hey, can we set up a call? Because Kirsten thinks this needs to be three books. And Wendy, my editor, immediately emailed back and was like, okay, make it three. And I was like, thank you.
Amazing.
Yeah, she really trusts me as a storyteller, which means the world as a writer. The existence of book two, first and foremost, is a surprise, or at least from the early days of planning. I knew exactly what needed to happen in the book with Radu, because Radu actually experiences the siege of Constantinople and the fall of Constantinople, which is a really particular thing that has been incredibly well researched and documented. We know everything that happened on each day. I felt it was important to be very accurate to the actual history. So his was a challenge in that, how do I make a story, a compelling character arc story out of something that really happened and that we already know the ending of? How do you create narrative tension? Spoiler alert, Constantinople isn't Constantinople anymore. We know it falls. Mm. How do you create narrative tension there? And then Lotto was, I was really departing heavily from Vlad's historical timeline. So hers was the first time where I was like, oh, I have a lot of leeway. What do I want to have happen? What does she need to do in order to have the character growth that I want her to have? What situations can I put her in? Those were the challenges, was that the one end was very structured and I had to work within very specific parameters. And then the other half of the narrative was very unstructured and I had to decide how best to work that. It was a challenge. Book twos are hard. They're always hard. Also, book threes are hard. And book ones are hard. Writing is hard. Why do we do this?
It's definitely really hard, but I think it does help to have a very strong support system. And again, you mentioned having your husband there too to be your soundboard. So that's very helpful. Do you also have writer friends or writer besties or buddies that jump in? Those are so incredibly crucial. It's a lonely process in itself to write and then to have all these thoughts racing in your head and not being sure which direction to go. I can't even imagine if the writers have no one to bounce ideas off of or just to say something out loud to. Oh my gosh, I think it would drive me nuts.
It's a strange industry and it's a strange profession. Most people do not understand it. My older sister is a lawyer. She's a brilliant writer. She's like, I could not even begin to conceive of a story. That's just so foreign to her. The writer friends who really understand, and they understand the difficulties and they understand the highs. Like you said, the sounding board. One of my best friends in the whole world and my writing partner is Stephanie Perkins, who wrote Anna the French Kiss, Lola and the Boy Next Door, and Isla and the Happily Ever After. And she's brilliant. And she's one of the kindest people that I know. The other day, I texted her at midnight. I might just be panicking, but I think I need to completely rework the second half of book three. Here's what I want to do and here's why. Am I just reacting? I don't know. Am I just reacting to stuff that's going on around me? But she knows this series. She knows these characters and she knows me. And so she wrote back, let's sit on this and talk about it tomorrow. And then 2 weeks later, she emails me and she's like, so how are you feeling? And I'm like, about what?
Oh my God.
You were panicking about 2 weeks. And I was like, oh, right. I was PMSing. Sorry. This is why I'm glad that I work with another woman. Anyway, so Steph and I were able to talk it through and talk about the reasoning and whether it was a reaction, if it should be a reaction. There's nothing wrong with it being a reaction to things that are going on in the world around us. It was just invaluable to me to have that person who was intimately familiar with my books and also me. Annie Perkins, I wouldn't be published without her. She's been so, so influential in my career. And the nice thing about Steph is we have opposite strengths. I'm really good at plotting and thinking on my feet and coming up with solutions. And she's really good at the finesse and the characterizations and the pushing everything deeper, we're a really good partnership. I also work really closely with Natalie Whipple, who I mentioned earlier, and we work in a different way. We read each other's writing as we write it. It's not so much an editorial or a critiquing process at that point. It's more cheerleader. It's like, oh, I love this. Like you said, it's a very lonely thing, and you're sitting at your computer by yourself. And so knowing that somebody is waiting for chapter by chapter, I find really, really helpful. And she has every once in a while, this was a huge tonal shift. I'm not sure why it went this way. Way back when I was writing Paranormalcy, I had Evie, who's this bright, bubbly, happy character, react really strongly, very darkly to something. And Natalie, who also knew me very well, was like, I feel like you're writing yourself in here, because I was going through some things at the time. And I was like, oh, you're right. I was writing myself into this. I wasn't writing Evie, and it needs to be Evie and how Evie would respond. It's nice having writers who understand and who will help you at different levels and on different aspects.
And writers who really know you.
Yeah.
Especially there are listeners who are so interested in finding these writing besties. Location does affect where you can find fellow writers, especially if you're living in a place where it's not that common. I always suggest to go online and find writing buddies. How did you find Natalie and Stephanie?
I did actually find Natalie and Steph both online, but this was way back in 2008 and 2009. I'm ancient in terms of YA.
Did you find them on forums or something?
Blogging.
Blogging. You're kidding.
Natalie and I actually connected on a different writing blog. The story with Natalie is so weird. Because we connected on this third site blog, and then we started getting to know each other, and then we realized we were from the same town. And she was like, really familiar. And we realized she had had a college class with my mom.
What?
Because my mom went back to school very late in life. And then we realized we had actually gone to high school together and had classes together.
You are kidding me. You didn't remember that?
No. So we met online. And then after we'd been friends for several months, realized that, oh, we went to high school together and had a class together.
You guys are fated.
We were meant to be. The funniest thing is I don't really remember her at all, but she remembers me because she was scared of me.
Were you a Lotta in high school?
I was not. Keep in mind, I was 4'11" and 95 pounds. I was the tiniest little thing, but I was very outspoken. And so I had a lot of political opinions and I would go after people in classes. So to her, I was terrifying. So I wrote a humor column for the newspaper. And at one point, I was not super nice about the prom. In my defense, the prom was held in our high school gym and they decorated the lockers with butcher paper. It was pretty awful. I wrote a humorous article, kind of poking fun of it. And she was on the prom committee.
Oh, no.
So, fortunately, she was able to see past unhappy Kirsten is not super nice. I wasn't a bully.
Listen, you spoke the truth.
I did. She was like, oh no, the prom was awful. You were 100% right.
You guys are the cutest.
So we met on the internet after we met in high school. And then Steph was really the same. We connected through blogging. I followed her agent's blog and her agent mentioned she had just signed this client. And I went to that client's blog and it was the single most adorable thing I had ever read in my life. And I was like, I have to have this person in my world. I have to be her friend, which I don't do very often.
I'm curious what she wrote now. I want to read that article.
It was just so utterly charming and delightful. Steph, if you've read any of her books, you know she's utterly charming and delightful. I started leaving comments on her blog. She started leaving comments on mine. We developed some inside jokes. And then this is so stalkery of me. I can say this now because we've been best friends for like 7 years. I was on sub with a different book that didn't end up selling. And I had finished writing Paranormalcy, which was my first book that actually sold. I really, really wanted her for a critique partner, but I was too shy to ask because I didn't want her to feel obligated. So I wrote on my blog, I have this new book and I really want a critique partner who hasn't read any of my other stuff because I want a fresh perspective on it. Is there anyone who have time to read this book? I only wanted Steph to respond. She did. She emailed me and she was like, I would love to read. I was like, oh, would you? Gosh.
She had no idea. She was totally set up.
A couple other people responded. I was like, oh, sorry, I already found someone. I definitely went after her.
You know what? It just shows you have to put yourself out there or else this would not have happened. Your best friendship would never have formed.
It can be intimidating. Like, it's scary to share your work with people. I will say, Steph, I feel really pushed me because I was good. But then Steph showed me how to self-edit and to get from good to publishing good. Without her advice, I think it would have taken me a lot longer. Those critique partners, I think it's good to find people who are very similar to you, but also if you can find people with different strengths, then you both bring a lot to the table that the other person doesn't necessarily have. I found mine online / high school / stalking them. I really enjoy going to writing retreats and connecting with people there, although that can be expensive. I do think that writing conferences can be very, very valuable, but again, it can be cost and travel prohibitive for people. Whereas the internet is a cesspool, but it's a free cesspool. I know that my sister-in-law, Eliza Wass, who also is a published author, she found a lot of her critique partners on Twitter by participating in pitch wars. She found a lot of really good critique partners and friends through that. So any ways you can find to get involved in the writing community, I think those are always going to be avenues that will lead you to find people who will be good critique partners and who will.
I love that. That was very helpful. What caught my attention especially was you saying that it's important to find someone that balances you and your strengths are plotting. Could we use And I Darken as an example? Starting off with your first draft, where do you start off? Because you don't have an outline, but then how do you actually plot?
I do have outlines more for this series because I do want to hit as many actual historical events as I can. So I did a ton of research and I had pages and pages and pages on their actual lives so that I could refer to those and be, oh, that's a really cool thing, or oh, that's an intriguing series of events. How can I use those? One thing that I found really, really useful, especially if you're working on deadline or if you need help motivating yourself, which we all do. If you don't, there's something wrong with you. And this was actually during writing book 2 when I really was struggling. I found the best thing that I could do is I have the loose outline. This is what needs to happen in this book. And so I would write a chapter. And after I finished the chapter, before I stopped working for the day, I would go to the next page so that I didn't have a blank white page. I would write just 3 or 4 sentences of, this is what needs to happen next. So that the next day when I sat down, I was not sitting down to a blank white page. I was sitting down to instructions that I had left for myself on what needed to happen next. And that has been a massively helpful drafting tool. And it took me how many books to figure that out? Way too many. Leaving that path for yourself. If you outline, that's awesome. You're lucky. That's great. Good for you. I envy your life. If you don't, just leaving that pathway for yourself and planning even just the next few scenes so that you know where you're aiming. So you're not just sort of spinning your wheels, trying out different things. Just having an action plan, even if it's just for the next chapter, I find really, really helps in getting things done. And as far as plotting, I think asking questions, what do I need to have happen emotionally for the characters? What is the most interesting sequence of events that can accomplish that?
Thank you so much for that. I think that's a huge, huge, huge help. Also, you mentioned that Steph was amazing at helping you figure out and giving you advice from going from first draft to something that was more presentable. That's something that listeners are actually reaching out about. If there's anything that you can advise them, I would love that.
Yeah, that's so hard because it's so different for every book. Every book I write is hugely flawed in a different way. I think one really concrete piece of advice that I can give is never give your readers a reason to put the book down. One thing that I did in my very first YA novel that I wrote that is not published and will never be published, and that's a good thing, is I was constantly ending chapters on the main character going to sleep. Because to me, while I was drafting, that felt like a very natural ending. The action for the day is accomplished and now she goes to sleep. But when you do that, you're giving the reader permission to also go to sleep or to put the book down because they're not feeling like they're going to be missing anything because you've left them on a lull, literal dead space. One thing that I've tried to do ever since somebody pointed that out to me was I tried to leave every chapter with a shape where it's swinging up into the next chapter. So you have the arc of the chapter, you have the shape of the chapter. And then at the very end, rather than having a flat line at the bottom, you swing the readers up into the action of the next chapter. So whether you're ending on a question, whether you're ending on a note of tension, whether you're ending on somebody bursting through the door with a sword, that would be weird if you were writing contemporary. That type of thing where you have that motion where the chapter has a shape, but it also flings you into the next one. So there's that sense of, oh gosh, I can't stop here. That just one more chapter, just one more chapter, just one more chapter. And that to me makes a huge difference in readability if you can figure out how to keep that momentum going between chapter breaks, whether it's just ending the chapter earlier or never letting your character sleep. If you're like me and you're a mom and your son had you up for 4 hours last night because he had a fever, you can channel that rage into never letting your character sleep. I don't get to sleep. My characters don't either. Keeping that movement, and that applies to more than just chapter endings. For example, in Paranormalcy, I had this really long chapter of Evie spending the day at high school. And I loved it. It was super fun. And she got to make all these funny jokes and go through this entire day at high school. But it brought the momentum of the plot to like a grinding halt. I ended up realizing what I loved about that chapter was actually like 3 or 4 lines. And guess what? You can move those to other places. So I was able to take the things that were the reason why I loved that chapter and put them other places and then just get rid of it. So it didn't slow the pacing down. I think sometimes we get really attached to certain scenes or certain sequences of events like, oh, it has to happen this way. It never has to happen that way. Writing is all moving parts. You can have the exact same goal accomplished in 40 different ways. And maybe you're not having that goal accomplished in the most interesting way that you can. If you can take a step back and say, how can I get to point B, but in a more engaging way, you'll always be able to find something.
Another amazing advice from you. You are a goddess. Thank you, Kirsten. You mentioned earlier about writing retreats that, yes, it's very true. It can be very expensive. If there are those who have saved up money, working hard, and are so excited to get out there and meet writers in person and love that atmosphere, are there any that you can recommend?
Absolutely. I really love Madcap retreats. They're run by Natalie Parker, who's a YA author, and they've got all sorts of different retreats. They've got a debut author retreat, so if you have a book deal, you can go connect with other people who are in the exact same stage as you. They've got retreats for established writers, but then they've also got aspiring writers workshops where it's a writing retreat, but every day you're hearing presentations and workshops. So you're getting specific instruction from established writers. I taught a class on voice, which was really fun because voice is one of those nebulous things. And you might think, like, how do you teach voice? Voice is just something that you have or you don't have. But it's definitely something that you can learn. And every skill in writing is something that you can learn. I think sometimes we get precious about things and we think, oh, it's a talent. It's innate. It's not. You can learn anything. And that's the value of hearing from different writers is everybody approaches something a little bit differently. And you're going to pick something up that you wouldn't have come to on your own. So Madcap Retreats, I really love. They do that Aspiring Writers Workshop. And it seemed like I would visit the house and eat lunch and dinner with the writers there. And they were making a lot of good connections with each other. In addition to learning a lot, they were finding critique partners. And the Madcap Retreats are really, really well run. They also offer scholarships for writers from a diverse background, which I think is fantastic. I love that. I actually donated my time to that one just because I love what they're doing with it. If you can get to a Madcap Aspiring Writers Workshop, I really, really recommend them. They do a fantastic job.
Thank you so much for that recommendation. If you're comfortable with sharing, if there was a moment that you really hit rock bottom, you could share that point of breakthrough if you remember how you got yourself out of it.
Yeah. Well, see, the nice thing about me is I've been writing and having a writing career for so many years. Now I have several rock bottom points.
That's amazing. Thank you. You're human.
It's great to hear because I'm still here and I'm still doing it. Earlier on when I was querying, I had one day, and this is terrible. I was querying for a young adult novel and I had an agent. It was my very first full request. She requested the full manuscript and I was so excited and I was sure she was going to be my agent. And I got a rejection letter from her an hour before I started miscarrying. Everything was rejecting me in the universe. The agent was rejecting me. My body was rejecting me. It was so many levels of pain. After that, I was like, you know what? Whatever. I can handle this.
I would have been bawling and I'm like, leave me alone.
Don't get me wrong. Oh. I was totally, totally a mess. I actually still can't see that agent's name without having PTSD. Poor thing. It has nothing to do with her. But I had a friend to talk me through it. And I did kind of realize at that point, I'm like, you know what? Let's get some perspective. An agent rejecting you is not actually the worst thing that can happen to you in a day. So I'm just going to keep going. And I know that this can't destroy me. This can't end my goals. And so I did. I kept going and I found my agent with that same manuscript not very long after. That was a very, very low point. In retrospect, it did give me a little bit of perspective. Yeah, getting rejected by an agent is not the worst thing that can happen to you in a day. And you keep going. I've also had low points in my career where I felt books didn't work out the way that I wanted them to sales-wise. Maybe something wasn't working out with a publisher. But at the end of the day, you have to be able to reconcile that writing is both your thing that is so intimate and personal And if you're pursuing publishing, it's also a business. And that can be a really, really hard thing to wrap your head around and to come to terms with. Because in the end, a book is a product. And it's hard to think about it that way. And it feels very crass. But it is a product. To be able to take a step back and say, okay, what I'm doing for whatever reason is not working or has stopped working. What is something that I can do that I'm passionate about and that I love that will shift things in a different direction? And for me, Anti-Darkroom was that different direction. It's a very large step away from what I had been writing previously because I felt I needed a fresh start. And so for me, you know, it was a very epic, long, violent fresh start. When we hit those rock bottom moments, they suck. Give yourself permission to cry. Give yourself permission to be angry at everything and let yourself have those feelings because they're completely valid. But once you've worked through them, decide, is it still worth it to me to pursue this? Yes. Okay, then I'm going to keep going. Is it still worth it to me to create stories? Yes. Okay, then I'm going to figure out a different way to create stories so that I can keep going in this. I think there's value in those low points because they really force us to evaluate, why are we doing this? What do we want from it? And what aspects of it can we control?
I just got chills, Kirsten. Thank you for that. That was very powerful. You're such a beautiful soul and so generous. And I can feel that.
Thank you for doing this. I feel I've been given so much help in my writing journey from friends and from people who are further ahead in the path than I am. I always love opportunities like this to reach out and to share whatever I've managed to learn. And if any of it is helpful, that's important to me to give back to the writing community that I've gotten so much from. So thank you for facilitating things like this, because heaven knows I'm not organized enough to do it.
That meant a lot. Kirsten, what is the proudest moment in your career?
Yes. So I've had a lot of really amazing things. Yes, yes. A lot of tremendous good fortune. You know, bestseller lists, or the day that I found out Paranormalcy was going to be in the Scholastic book catalog, which as a child was like the greatest thing ever. That was like an oh my gosh moment. But I will say the moment that stands out to me the most happened a couple of years ago. I was doing a library event and I have a book called The Chaos of Stars. It's one of my more divisive books. People either love it or they're like, what on earth was this? And that's fine. But it's not one of my more popular books. I was signing books and I had a girl come up, and she's a teenage girl, and she set down The Chaos of Stars and she said, I need to tell you how much this book meant to me. I have a lot of sisters. I feel like my mom and I don't understand each other. A lot of times I feel like she doesn't see me or who I am or appreciate me. And I needed this book. And that right there, I mean, you feel that all the way through when somebody says something like that, because Chaos of Stars is the book that I would have given myself as a teenager out of all of my books. The heart of that book is, just because people don't love us the way that we think that they should doesn't mean that they don't love us. For it to have meant something to a teenage girl who probably is very much like I was at the time was just this moment of, okay, this is why I write for teenagers. This is why I do it. And I will always remember that moment and that girl, because it was just such an honor to have been able to provide that for her. And I'm so grateful for that.
I have goosebumps, by the way, before we move on to the wrap up at the end. What is the best advice that you can give to our listeners? This time I'm going to switch it up and ask you specifically in terms of writing a strong voice, because I know you mentioned that you taught voice for Madcap. What's the one best advice you can give to the listeners who may be struggling with a unique voice or a strong voice throughout their manuscript?
I would say give yourself permission to write with a strong voice. That's really what made the difference in my career. In my early books, I was writing how I thought I was supposed to write. And then in Paranormalcy, I was like, I'm going to write how I want to write. I'm going to write her funny and weird and use my own sense of humor. That's what people responded to. The main thing with voice is give yourself permission to go all out. Don't hold it back. Really let yourself go in deep with who those characters are and what their voice would sound like. Yeah, you're going to turn off some readers, but it's going to be because you have created such an authentic, real voice. If your book appeals to everyone who ever picks it up, there's something wrong with that. I think that authenticity is so valuable, and you can bring something to that writing that no one else can, because your voice is the one thing that can't be recreated or imitated. Anybody can write a story on any prompt. You can have an idea that everybody else has had. There are no original ideas, but your voice is the thing that you're going to bring to your writing. So give yourself permission to embrace it, and don't worry about it being wrong. There's no such thing as a wrong voice.
Absolutely. Digging a little bit deeper for those who may be blocked in tapping into their authenticity, their authentic voices, do you have a suggestion for them of how they can remove that shield? Sometimes people have a fear and are just so self-critical and can't get in touch with their core. Mm-hmm. Do you have advice for that?
I would try writing in a different way than you normally do, whether that means writing by hand. I mean, I had a book where I sat outside and wrote by hand the entire book.
Wow.
Because I was having such a hard time focusing. But when I did it that way, I couldn't go back. I couldn't edit as I was writing. I couldn't do those self-editing things that we tend to get stuck on. And so that really, really helped me unlock that story and that voice. So anything that you can do to kind of shake yourself out of a routine so that you can just focus on the words in front of you, I think it's going to be helpful.
Thank you, Kirsten. And one more final wrap up. Is there a favorite book, whether it's a how-to for the craft of writing or any fiction that really made a huge impact on you growing up?
You know, what's so interesting is so many times the formative books of our youth, we go back and read them as adults and it's like, oh, this actually isn't very good, but you connect with it so much because you read it when you're young. But I recently reread Anne of Green Gables, which I read and loved so much as a girl because it was the first book I read where I felt I knew her and that she was similar to me. Anne was allowed to be an actual girl. She didn't feel like a character, she felt like a person, and that someone saw that much value in an imaginative, smart, ambitious girl to give her her own book was mind-blowing to me. I had never read that before, and I think even still, that's fairly rare. And I went and reread that book as an adult, and you get such a different story reading as an adult that you do as a child, but it was still just this astonishingly beautiful, quiet, relatively plotless story that I found so inspiring that Lucy Maud Montgomery, the author, gave that much value to an imaginative girl who just wants to be loved and do the things that will give her a future that she never thought she could have. And I would recommend any book, like any book that you loved as a child, reread as an adult and as a writer and see what they did that lodged so deeply in your heart. I think exploring those things as an adult and as a writer really brings a lot of value.
Absolutely. Kirsten, thank you again for your time.
Well, thank you so much for hosting me. This was wonderful.
And that wraps up our episode with the awesome Kirsten White. Kirsten, you were so much fun to have on the show, and thank you for all of your transparency. Storytellers, I hope you all enjoyed Kirsten's episode as much as I loved sharing it with you. I am so grateful for your support, and thank you for hanging out with us every week. Please say hi to Kirsten on Twitter at Kirsten White and head over to her show notes page at 88cupsoftea.com/podcast/Kirsten White. So remember when I talked about Overdrive and their new app, Libby? Okay, so first off, I've been a huge fan of Overdrive for 6 years. I first discovered them when I moved into my own place for the first time ever and needed a positive distraction after a breakup. The library down the block from me had these pamphlets about Overdrive that explained how to borrow ebooks and audiobooks with my library card. I was obsessed and started borrowing audiobooks back to back, starting off with some self-help books to give me a boost during the breakup. Fast forward 6 years, I am super happy and have grown a lot as a person. And it's awesome to see that Overdrive has gone the same direction in terms of growth and expansion and now has Libby, their brand new app they built with a lot of love. The app was designed to get people reading as quickly and seamlessly as possible. And this was all inspired by user and library feedback. So think of Libby like a librarian in your pocket. She's a one-tap reading app from your library and Overdrive. While millions of people around the world use their library to read books every day with Overdrive, half of the United States alone doesn't have a library card. Overdrive wants to change that with Libby. Libby has also been designed to recommend awesome books to read next. I honestly could not be more proud to collaborate with a team that exists to spread literacy, reading, and libraries. Be sure to download Libby on your phone or tablet and rediscover the magic of libraries. Head over to meet.libbyapp.com. Again, that's meet.libbyapp.com. And don't forget to join our Facebook group if you're looking for an intimate community for storytellers where you can check in about your writing and hang out with other storytellers at facebook.com/groups/88cupsoftea. I can't wait to meet you in there. That's facebook.com/groups/88cupsoftea. Have an amazing rest of your week, and I'll catch you in the next episode.
Hey guys, it's me again. Thanks so much for listening in on 88 Cups of Tea. Go create something magical today, and I'll catch you in the next episode. Bye!